House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:25 on February 12th, 2016. With us today, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have two items on the calendar, House Bill 248, alcohol tax, and House Bill 252, vessel passenger tax. Wednesday, we had a presentation by the administration. Today, we have invited testimony from industry stakeholders. First up is 248. Let's see. With us, we have, I believe, Dale Fox.
He's going to be online.
Online. Diane Thompson and Ryan McKinster. I guess we'll start with Dale. Dale, are you with us today?
You ready for me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, welcome, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, my name is Dale Fox, and I'm the President and CEO of Alaska Char. In most categories in Alaska, we're the least taxed state in the nation. The exception is alcohol, where we're the highest taxed state in the nation. We pay the highest tax on wine, second highest tax on beer, and the second highest tax on spirits. But in aggregate, if you bought a gallon of each of those, you would pay the highest tax in the nation. Currently, the excise tax on spirits is $12.80, the second highest in the nation. Doubling it would take it to $25.60. The national average is $4.45. This would be 5.7 times the national average. The excise tax on wine is currently $2.50. Doubling it will take it to $5. National average is $0.83. So we'd be 6 times the national average in wine. And on beer, currently we're at $1.07. Go to $2.14. National average is $0.28, which means we'd be 7.6 times the national average. And I guess what I'm talking about here is an equity issue and an issue where we don't want to have a lot of unintended consequences. So let me give you one unintended consequence, and I'm sure as you receive testimony tomorrow and later today, you'll hear more. But the huge price discrepancy between what we would be charging in Alaska and what people could buy outside makes it possible to ship alcohol into Alaska using the Internet. You could simply skip the $5 a gallon tax on wine and buy from California, where the tax is 20 cents a gallon. So the difference between $5 a gallon and 20 cents a gallon would surely pay more than the UPS or FedEx fee to ship the alcohol to Alaska. The same is true if you bought spirits at $25.60 a gallon. You could skip that and buy from Kentucky at $1.92. And the Internet allows us to do that these days, and people can get it shipped here fairly inexpensively. So we have a challenge where making our tax off the charts compared to other taxes in the nation, people do what makes sense. They will buy their product off the Internet, as they are with so many other products. The same kind of thing could happen with beer. And usually you think, golly, beer's pretty heavy and it's hard to ship. But Oregon taxes at 8 cents a gallon. So simply buy your beer in Oregon, your whiskey in Kentucky, and your wine in California, and you could freely ship it here, skipping the Alaska tax, skipping the distributors and the retailers who would make money on that that project. So that's one unintended consequence, and I think I'll just leave you with the fact that we're paying the highest tax in the nation. We shouldn't be looked at to pay seven times the national average, and we'd appreciate you defeating this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Fox? Thanks again, Dale.
Thank you.
Diane Thompson, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to. My name's Diane Thompson. I'm president of the Alaska Hospitality Retailers Association. We're a coalition of restaurants, hotels, retailers, and coffee shops. We're not the liquor lobby, but many of our venues do sell liquor as part of our services to our customers. I'm one of the owners of Firetap in Anchorage. I'm speaking today in the opposition of the proposed increase in the liquor taxes. We don't believe that this action is justified and that if government, which we know needs more money, we would suggest that maybe you implement a general sales tax. That way liquor sales would also pay their part but would not be singled out. We do not believe that there's good policy reasons for doubling the tax on alcohol. I think you have materials in front of you that compare wine, beer, and spirit taxes in Alaska, and like Dale said, we're already paying some of the highest tax in the nation. Some people say that if we raise the price, people will drink less. We've also provided you with an article from the Daily News, which was printed after the last major increase in alcohol taxes, and the data shows that the liquor sales did not decline at all, but in fact, they increased. So, and we've also heard people argue that we need more liquor taxes to provide treatment for people with alcohol problems. We do not have a problem with this concept, but many of the taxes we're already collecting are not going to alcohol treatment. In fact, some of our members from Fairview lobbied the legislature a couple of years ago for a $4 million appropriation to deal directly with the chronic inebriates in Anchorage. And with your support, I think, is Chairman Stoltz there? Yes. Sadly enough, our members have reported to us that this program was changed by the Department of Health and Social Services into a homeless program, and now a year and a half, 2 years later, not a dollar of it has been spent on alcohol treatment. Not a single person has gone into a treatment program. So, Mr. Chairman, we do not believe there are good reasons to support the doubling of the liquor taxes in Alaska. We believe you should focus on general tax measures instead that could provide much more revenue, such as the sales tax. We do support the work of the legislature to bring Alaska's budget into balance. If we return to the recession years of 1985, our industry is one of the first to feel the loss of business and revenue. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Thompson? Thanks again for joining us. Next up is Ryan McKinster.
Thank you, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. My name is Ryan McKinster for the record. I am the Executive Director of the Brewers Guild of Alaska. And I want to just echo what the previous two testifiers brought to your attention. I agree with those. I want to focus on something a little different. I'm specifically speaking for an industry that's a knockout out of the larger industries they spoke to. Just to give you a little bit of color, the craft brew industry in Alaska last year provided approximately 965 direct jobs with a full-time equivalent job impact of approximately 1,700 positions. The craft brew industry in Alaska was responsible for a total economic impact of $454 million, and with almost $30 million in state and local taxes and fees at our current rates. That includes local, obviously, taxes, fees. One thing that may not be noticed in the bill, in the documentation you have now, is that we also pay fees, multiple licensing fees, which if any of you paid attention to the Title IV rewrite last year, there's multiple different license fees that we have to pay, my industry has to pay, as well as distillers and some others that participate in these industries and across the state. So this tax is not the only fee or tax that my industry pays. Total in-state expenditures, we also have approximately $150 million. That's direct expenditures from my member businesses to other businesses in their communities. Currently, I would be remiss not to point out the fact that there's an excise tax, and the tax numbers that Mr. Fox referenced when his testimony is the bigger number. Every one of our breweries actually falls under this knockout we will talk about in the current bill, as well as the old bill, or as the old statute refers to. So we actually currently pay 35 cents per gallon, which the national average is about 28 cents per gallon, so we're already higher than that. But this would double that excise tax of 70% cents per gallon, over twice the national average. All of my members currently fall under that. They are under that lower limit, but as well as other craft breweries that bring into the state. So it's not that our industry is protected or is singled out. All craft breweries or anybody that produces under that amount basically pays that same rate. Why I'm bringing this up is this industry has grown exponentially over the last few years. It's a very important part of the state. It's part of our communities. If you look at other states that have done economic expansion and look to bring people into their state, such as Boulder, Colorado, Portland's done a very good job, Oregon's done a very good job of it. There's actually smaller communities on the East Coast that do it well. And one of the things, in addition to the great quality of life we have with fishing and skiing and outdoor sports, wineries, distilleries, and the craft brew industry, what we consider the craft industry, has been an important part for the younger generation that are looking where to move themselves or their families for economic opportunity. One reason I kind of want to reference some of the numbers are, even though all breweries, whether they're craft breweries out of state or in state, are going to be affected by this 35 to 70 cents per gallon change, breweries out of state send their finished product to us, so that's their one shipping cost. My industry members pay for almost everything but water. The glass and cans are not produced locally because we do not have that capacity, and they're shipped up on pallets, as well as our hops and a lot of our other products. There's been some talk about developing some of those materials up here, but that doesn't happen yet. So we're paying the full cost of those up here in addition to this tax that the other industry pays. They just pay one shipping cost, which is usually lots more efficient than the multiple ingredients that my members have to deal with. So doubling of any tax is a big issue for my members. As you probably know, craft breweries and craft brew products are usually a higher price point product than some of the macro brews and other things like that. When you get to a certain price level, you start pricing people out of the market for this higher quality product, and other states have seen once that happens, the general public will look to get other products. So you not only will have them look at other products, most likely they'll be out-of-state products since all of our brews in the state are craft brews. Finally, I just want to point out one fact is, as we are diversifying our economy, the state has also worked with our industry as well as the distilling industry to promote our industries as they saw it as a good economic driver. It is one of the only manufacturing industries currently in the state that's looking to expand, and it seems a little bit counterproductive to double the tax for this industry that the state is on another venue trying to promote with the public and with out-of-state press as well as aficionados of our industry. Thank you.
Thanks again. Any questions for Ryan? Well, we're out of public testimony from the alcohol industry, and we will hold the bill over. We're going to have public testimony tomorrow on both of these bills. So we'll set aside 252 and take up 248 and take up 252. Looks like John Binkley's first. Come on up, John. Brief at ease. We have John Binkley, the president of the Alaska Cruise Association, and take as much time as you want because we're ahead of schedule.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to testify on House Bill 252 this afternoon. As the chairman mentioned, my name is John Binkley, and I have the privilege of serving as president of the Alaska Cruise Association. However, Mr. Chairman, I think before I begin, I should disclose to the committee that I do have a conflict of interest on this piece of legislation. I also serve as chairman of our family tour business in Fairbanks, where we have operated river tours through five generations now. My mother is still involved in the business, my siblings and their kids. My adult children run the business, and I have eight grandkids, Judy and I do, that are now getting involved in the business as well. So we have a very personal interest in this legislation, in this business, and I sometimes get confused which hat I've got on. Am I representing the cruise lines, or am I representing my family and the other 46,000 Alaskans who are employed in this industry? So please forgive me if sometimes I get confused as to which hat I have on. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll begin. We represent the Alaska Cruise Line Association, 12 members. You can see the members on the screen that we represent. Those 12 members bring to Alaska almost a million passengers each year, visitors coming to Alaska. Last year there were 31 ships, 487 voyages bringing visitors up to Alaska. And of those voyages, Mr. Chairman, and those total of about a million passengers, about two-thirds are round-trip visitors that come up through southeast Alaska and go back to the Seattle area or Vancouver. The other third come up through southeast Alaska from Vancouver across the Gulf of Alaska to south central Alaska, to Whittier or Seward, or to the Port of Anchorage, Kodiak, those areas. Typically those are one-way voyages, so visitors get off then, spend time in the Anchorage, Kenai Peninsula area, going up through the Matsu Valley, up to Denali, and hopefully on to Fairbanks and go on a riverboat ride once they're there. And then they conclude and fly home, and then the reverse of that pattern. Other people are flying in, going through the land tour through south central Alaska, get on a cruise ship, and then go one way back down to Vancouver through southeast. Okay, we're currently on slide, I don't know what the number of that is. I'd refer to the slide number, Mr. Chairman, but I don't know what it is. This is the slide that's the overview of the cruise industry. So that really kind of gives you a perspective on our members and the number of passengers and individuals that we bring to Alaska and how they get here. I want to talk, as we talk about House Bill 252, really three things. To first talk about the history of how we got here with the entry fee taxes that are now charged for cruise visitors that come to Alaska. Some of the legal issues surrounding the taxing of those visitors and how those funds can be expended. And then talk a little bit about the public policy that's involved in House Bill 252. Just to give you a perspective on how large the visitor industry is in Alaska, and this next slide is entitled Visitor Volumes to Alaska, and you can see that the cruise passengers are roughly one-half of the visitors that come to Alaska. Almost a million passengers by cruise ship. We have almost 900,000 that come by air, and then another 80,000 visitors that come through our Alaska Marine Highway system, through the ferry, and also drive up the Alaska Highway and come in by road.
John, what's the breakdown on that category, roughly, the 4% between the ferry and the highway?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman. I can certainly get those numbers for you.
I'm just curious. I guess it's not pertinent to this, but I
should know that, but I don't have it.
Gotcha.
And here are the economic impacts, really, from those 2 million visitors and how they impact the state of Alaska. You can see, by far and away, South Central is the biggest beneficiary of the employment, the labor income, and the spending from those visitors, almost $1.8 billion. The interior, my hometown, that area, about $500 million. Southeast, just over $1 billion. Southwest Alaska, $115 million. And the far north, about $25 million, totaling about $3.5 billion of economic impact in Alaska. I want to talk a little bit about the history of the growth of the industry. Now, this chart is just the cruise industry growth. And you can see that since the mid-90s, when cruising became very popular to Alaska, you can see how it was really on a trajectory and growing very rapidly in Alaska. But that really changed in 2007 and beyond. And the reason it changed was an initiative. There's a couple of different reasons. There were some economic changes in the country in 2008 and 2009. But also there were some pretty dramatic policy changes, tax policy changes in Alaska specific to the cruise industry. And it really was embodied in an initiative, a ballot measure, that was passed in 2006, went into effect really in 2007. It implemented five new taxes just on the cruise visitors that came to Alaska, just on the large cruise ship passengers that came to Alaska. It also, and you can see that totaled about $68 million in taxes that were generated, which don't include the $15 million in local entry fee taxes that were in place. There were new regulatory requirements, and there was a requirement to have full-time state contractors on board the ships referred to as Ocean Rangers. With the implementation of all these new taxes and requirements, the cruise lines looked at the return on investment for their assets. They're publicly traded companies, and they're responsible to their shareholders to get the maximum return on their shareholders' investments in those assets. And they will move those assets. One of the benefits of the model for the cruise industry is that you have assets that are very mobile so that they can be moved from one destination to another wherever they can get the highest rate of return. And so when they're looking at where they could get the best rate of return on those assets, they decided to redeploy ships to other destinations around the world where they could, as they're obligated to do, get a better return for their shareholders on their invested capital. And with that redeployment of ships out of Alaska, we lost about 142,000 cruise visitors that no longer came to Alaska. So they no longer contributed to Alaska's economy. There was an estimated $150 million in less spending from those visitors. And we lost, according to a report through the Department of Commerce, over 5,000 jobs in Alaska. The impact of that was higher in South Central Alaska because most of the ships, or a majority of the ships proportionally, that went across the Gulf of Alaska to South Central were pulled out of Alaska. So we felt it very hard. I know in our personal business, we felt it hard. We had to lay off people, many people that were longtime employees. It's a difficult thing to do when you do that, and you have to downsize because the business is just not there. But it hurt a lot of Alaska businesses when that happened.
Did it have the same impact on Fairbanks and the interior?
It did, Mr. Chairman. We have, and I always like to characterize ourselves as a small family business. That's what it was certainly as I grew up. I've been in it all my life, but it has grown. We went from 210 employees down to 140 employees. So we lost 70 employees. Those are friends, acquaintances, people that we know, families that no longer had a job, people, young people going through college who didn't have an opportunity to earn money for their college education, retired people who add to their fixed income with summer employment, teachers many times who work in the summer as well. It's a lot of impact just in our business, and that was spread around the state as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Binkley. One of the other things I think that was going on that I haven't seen numbers to substantiate is in 2008 we had a significant market crash and the economy collapse in the rest of the country. I can't imagine that did not have an impact at all on the cruise industry.
It did. Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kito, you're absolutely right. As I mentioned before, the economic downturn in 2008 and 2009 affected all travel to Alaska. And it affected the cruise lines as well. But those assets that they pulled out of Alaska, they just put them other destinations. They didn't lay up those ships because there weren't visitors who wanted to go someplace on a cruise ship. They just simply moved them to a different destination where they could get a better return on those assets. So, as with most things, it's a combination of things that really cause a lot of those problems. So, as a result of that, to the credit of the administration and the legislature, they wanted to know what they could do to turn that around, to get those 5,000 jobs back for Alaskans. And in addition to that, the industry felt compelled to seek guidance from the court in how these entry fee taxes that were being charged to the visitors were actually being expended within the state. And so they felt compelled to file litigation in federal court and to, as I said, get some guidance on how these monies could actually be spent. So the legislature and the administration, in looking at that, the loss of the jobs, the loss of the ships, the litigation that was pending in terms of what the impact might be in a ruling that could jeopardize all of the head taxes, sought a settlement of some number that the cruise lines might agree to that would be fair for the state to collect still a significant portion of money from those visitors, and yet wouldn't be so excessive that it was expended on things that weren't in compliance with the U.S. Constitution and federal law. So as a result of that settlement agreement, which brought the number of or the amount of entry fee taxes from $46 down to $34.50, it also leveled the playing field so that all cruise ship visitors that were coming to Alaska paid the same amount. Before that, there was a discrepancy. Visitors coming to Juneau and Ketchikan paid more than other visitors, so it leveled that by giving an offset to those who stopped in those two ports. And it also changed the state law to really parallel the federal law. To clarify, under the Constitution, U.S. Constitution, and federal law that that laid out the constitutional limits, to parallel those so that it was clear how those funds could be spent. And a key provision in that was to make certain that the funds were used for the passengers and the ships. And federal law and now state law is very clear in that, to use the conjunctive and I've got that highlighted here, and in bold, passengers and ships. So any funds that are taxes, entry fee taxes that are collected, must be expended in a service to the ship and the passenger. And this is where many people get confused. They think it's the ship or the passenger. If it's simply something that the passenger uses, the expenditure is justified. It's not. It has to be a nexus to the ship as well. Because under that, and we can go into that later, but under the tonnage clause, that's really the key provision that gives it the nexus to the ship itself. So that was clarified in state statutes to parallel federal statutes. And it also, in that legislation, there was a provision that changed from the original voter initiative. The voters had said in the initiative that any port that had an existing head tax, like Ketchikan and Juneau, was not eligible to get the $5 per passenger that would be rebated back to the communities, since they already had their own head taxes. So that was changed in that legislation as well. And it said that in addition to all the other ports that get the $5 per head, $5 will go to Juneau and $5 will go to Ketchikan in addition. And that is what really brought down then the amount that the state retained of those entry fee taxes that were collected. So that was really amounted to almost another $10 million that went out of the state funds out to the communities. So as I think was pointed out by the Department of Revenue earlier, it brought down the portion that the state retains to just about $2 million each year. Of all the entry fee taxes that they collect, the vast majority goes out to communities. The state only retains about $2 million per year. We also feel on the legal issues, and I think this was a point that was brought up at your committee meeting on Wednesday. Yep. By Representative Ledoux, the point that this could jeopardize, really, the settlement agreement that the industry and the state entered into in order to dismiss the litigation that we had pending. And that this bill could, as was pointed out by the representative and the other committee members, this could raise constitutional issues that were asserted under the 2009 litigation. And these really are the pertinent portions that litigation in 2009 pointed to. And I think Department of Law alluded to this in the Wednesday meetings as well. There's the tonnage clause of the U.S. Constitution that talks about the laying on of any duty of tonnage. And, of course, tonnage is means not just the weight of the vessel or the displacement of the vessel, but also the passengers on the vessel as well. And the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and then the relative federal statutes, 33 U.S.C. 5, and that really goes to when the state changed the statute to parallel federal statute to make certain that we didn't have a claim under the Supremacy Clause, because before our statutes were not in parallel with the U.S. statutes. And so the legislation in 2010 paralleled those so that the Supremacy Clause wouldn't be an issue. And I just want to kind of drive this point home about the Commerce Clause particularly. I want to just bring you back to this slide that I brought up earlier. And this is the one that talks about the visitor volumes coming to the state, the cruise ship passengers being about half, a million of those, that we charge, the state charges an entry fee of $34.50 each. So if you're a visitor who wants to come to Alaska on a cruise ship, you have to pay an entry fee to get into Alaska of $34.50. Now, this bill proposes to increase that by $15 per passenger to raise that entry fee. But I might suggest that instead of just raising the fee on a million passengers by $15, why don't you just implement a fee of $34.50 on the other million visitors that come to Alaska? You could simply have a $34.50 entry fee on any passenger that visitor that flies to Alaska on an airlines. Just tack that on to the cost of the airfare. Probably wouldn't notice it, just another $34.50. You could do the same for the Marine Highway System when they make the reservation on the Marine Highway System. Just tack on a fee of $34.50. And for the highway traffic, just put a toll booth at the border coming from Canada into Alaska and have a state worker there to collect from each motorhome that comes in $34.50 from each person on the motorhome. They certainly aren't going to turn around and drive back to Ohio after they've come all that way. And why wouldn't we do this? Well, that's a bit absurd, really, because the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution says, and the framers of the Constitution said, we want free travel and free commerce in this United States of America. And we want people to go from border to border, state to state, without having a toll booth, where each state collects a toll simply for going through their state. And that's the Commerce Clause, and that's one of the problems that we bump up against when we say that if you're a cruise passenger coming to Alaska, we're going to charge you a toll for coming into this state. Now, legitimately, the state can charge a fee, but it has to be a service that they provide to that passenger and the ship that's bringing them to Alaska. And so we have different fees that we charge people who drive on our highways, motor fuel taxes, other taxes for trucks that drive on the road, licenses and whatnot. But we have to make sure that it's a fee for a service we provide them. And that's the same thing that we're talking about with the cruise passengers as well.
Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a series of a couple of questions regarding this.
We've got lots of time.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Bickley. So do you have an idea, I guess, of what the average fare that a traveling cruise ship passenger pays to do one of the trips on the cruise ship?
Representative Keto, through the chair, if I might, Mr. Chairman. I don't have an average, Representative Keto, but if you go just on the internet or TripAdvisor or a lot of these cheapcruises.com, you can get what the current fares are. Some of them right now for cruises to Alaska are as low as $4.99 per person, $3.99 per person. There's some very, very low fares out there. There are some fares that cost $6,000 or $7,000 per person if you want a stateroom, you know, one of the suites. On some cruise, luxury cruise liners, they're even higher than that. They're $16,000, $17,000. So for some visitors, $34.50, it's meaningless. They're going to go on a cruise no matter what. But for those that are required to make the economics work, the ones that are paying $4.99 or $3.99, $34.50 per person in their family makes a difference. And it's the difference between going to destination A, B, or C. So it does make a difference, but I don't know the average.
Thank you. Follow up. And so on the Commerce Clause, the Tonnage Clause, and all of those other items, you indicated that during this negotiation, the state of Alaska had modified statute to provide that the funding could only be used for certain purposes that benefit the passenger and the vessel?
Through the chair? Representative Keto, that's correct.
And
in the statute, it uses the conjunctive and rather than the disjunctive or.
And is this being repealed by the tax increase or the actual language in front of us?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, there could be a case for that. I think that's what Representative Ledoux brought up at the committee meeting on Wednesday, that maybe we're better to leave well enough alone. There could be a challenge to the tax. We entered a settlement agreement. We had a deal. The cruise lines have adhered to that deal. We brought ships back. We brought those 142,000 passengers per year back. We've paid millions of dollars over the years in these taxes and have not challenged them. But this could be seen as going back on that agreement by increasing now those taxes that we settled this on.
I guess my question is, it seems like the discussion was more about what the funding was being used for and not the level. So does the Commerce Clause, the Tonnage Clause, or the Supremacy Clause identify a reasonable amount that we can charge, or does it not identify a reasonable amount?
Through the chair, mm-hmm. Representative Keto, it doesn't specify an amount.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Ortiz, and you're welcome to join us at the table if you'd like and ask questions. Mm-hmm. Nope, you don't want to join us?
I don't necessarily have the time, but I'm...
Oh, okay.
Very much.
Thanks for joining us.
It doesn't specify, Representative Keto, the amount. It just has to be in compliance. And every jurisdiction may be different. You know, it may be that it requires a service that is $34.50. It may be a service that only requires $20. Mm-hmm. Or maybe nothing. Maybe there's a private port that is owned by the private sector, private dollars that are utilized, a contract between the cruise lines and the private dock to be able to utilize the facility. And they really don't require any entry fee tax. And what most, I think what happens many times is that people get confused about this and think that you can take the tax and follow the passenger. Wherever the passenger is utilizing a service, that you can take that tax and follow it to that service. And that really is what southeastern towns like Juneau and Ketchikan and others around southeast have learned. The way you really capture the economic activity of the cruise industry is through local sales taxes. They're spending a tremendous amount of money, about $1,000 each per voyage is what they spend, and let's get a piece of that by charging them a sales tax. It's, I think, in Juneau, 20% of the total tax sales tax revenue comes from the cruise visitors stepping off the cruise ship. So that's the way you really take care of the services that are provided to the passenger alone is through a mechanism like a sales tax.
Yeah, last follow-up. New question, I think kind of same issue, I guess we're on the same bill, but a different, slightly different question. One of the thoughts that I had is, I guess you had mentioned an increase in the tax, but my understanding is the state tax is $34.50 and the state tax will remain $34.50, that there's no change in the state tax. The difference is that now the local tax assessed is actually added on top. So a local municipality has the choice of whether or not, excuse me, to implement or not have that tax. So the state of Alaska really isn't adding a tax, it's just removing an exemption for local charges for their taxes.
Through the chair, Representative Quito. Well, from the perspective of the visitor, they're adding a tax. They're paying $15 more if they stop at Ketchikan and Juneau. They're now paying $49.50 rather than $34.50. So there is an additional tax that's being paid in this legislation. And unless I'm not understanding your question.
But so my understanding is in the statute the tax is $34.50. The tax will remain $34.50 in statute. There's just a removal of the exemption that a municipal tax comes off of the top of the state tax.
Through the chair, Representative Quito, you can characterize it however you want, but it's an additional $15 per passenger for those that stop in Juneau and Ketchikan. So their taxes from the perspective of the passenger, their fares go up $15 each.
Thank you.
No more? Representative Hughes.
I have two different questions, Mr. Chair. You mentioned families and groups, and you hit a break point, especially on those low end of the fares. Is it accurate to say that it's more common now than when we first saw cruising in Alaska that families, it just seems like the marketing and the commercials I've seen, that it is more families and groups coming, and so you start multiplying that out with a group instead of thinking of it as $34.50 or $49.50, it becomes $200-$300. Is that accurate, that it's more common for groups to be traveling and making their decision as to their destination as a group?
Through the chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's absolutely true. The demographics are changing in the cruise visitor. I think generally all of the visitors that come to Alaska, they're getting younger, they're more family-oriented. And there are also many more grandparents now who are taking their grandchildren on cruises as well. So it's much more family-oriented. It's become more affordable. It's a great value for families. But they are price-sensitive because, as you point out, it's not just one person. It's a multiple of four or six that may be traveling together, and it starts to add up significantly.
Okay. New question.
Yeah, it's a new question. Thank you for that. I went back because I was trying to remember how much this would raise, so I looked back to see if the presentation the other day. So it says $14.8 million kept by the state, $1.8 million to municipalities. This would be the increase, the additional. And so, and then looking at the page there, the slide that doesn't have a number but talked about the various federal law that we might be running up against. What is your understanding of how that 14.8 collected by the state would be used and how that would be conflicted? Because this is all being presented as part of an equation that the governor's proposing to close a $3.8 billion fiscal gap. And so can you just talk to us about these federal laws, that $14.8 million and the problem with it, and will, in your eyes, does it help close the gap?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Madam Vice Chair, well, that really leads into this next slide, which talks about the expenditure of the funds, the entry fees that are collected from the passengers. This was a quote out of a letter to the legislature from Legislative Legal Services in September of 2009. This is before the litigation, and this was really, these are excerpts out of the letter, but really the key points, and it was a cautionary note to the legislature to be careful about how you expend those funds. And that goes to your point, Madam Vice Chair, is that these are not general funds, these are restricted funds. And so it goes into a special funds, and you have to, in the case of your legal services, cautioning you on how you expend those funds, because you can run afoul. In this case, it was talking about the federal law, 33 U.S.C. 5B2. That was an amendment to the Harbors and Waters Act of 1880-something, but really comes under the Commerce and the Tonnage Clause. And so it's saying to be cautious because this case law requires a service to the vessel, in addition to the passengers. And you can't take those funds far from the vessel. And so there's a restriction on how you can expend those funds. And that really then was changed in the legislation as a part of the settlement agreement. The legislation changed. Not only the rates came down, but the legislation then had state law paralleling that federal law so that the state wouldn't be running afoul of what the U.S. Constitution and federal law required. And so we amended AS 43-52-230 to put the word, and again, there's that conjunctive and, there has to be, for the expenditure of these funds, a nexus to the ship. So you can't just follow the passenger. It has to benefit the ship as well. So it becomes problematic the farther you go away from the dock, the service that the ship requires, as farther away you start spending those monies from the dock, then you start to run afoul of the U.S. Constitution and federal law, and now state law that says the same thing. And that really brings me to the next point about the state's responsibility in how they expend these funds, and not only for the funds that the state itself appropriates to specific projects, which is very low now. As was pointed out and discussed earlier, it's only about $2 million per year that the state actually appropriates out for specific projects. But the state collects those monies from the passengers, and they have a duty to make certain that those are expended within the guidelines of the U.S. Constitution, federal law, and now state law, as they pass those out to the communities. So they have a responsibility to make sure the communities are spending those within the bounds of state law as well. And that really brings up a concern and speaks to this piece of legislation as well. And with all due respect to the representative from Juneau, I'm going to give you an example. Right here in the capital city, the city and borough of Juneau gets approximately $13 million per year total. Some of their own entry fee taxes, some state taxes that are passed on through the city and borough of Juneau. And you may all recognize this. This is a phenomenal structure that's going to be here in Juneau. It's a breaching whale that's a massive bronze monument, and it has a very phenomenal waterworks that every 49 minutes will spout and appear as though the whale is breaching out of the water. It's in a reflective pool that looks down over the channel. Local private contributions have funded the actual bronze whale itself, but cruise ship head taxes, entry fee taxes that passengers are paying, are going to fund the foundation for this, the waterworks that are involved in this, and also the way that visitors get to this whale. And this is an example of what we think has gone wrong with this and why it's apparent to us that too many entry fee dollars and taxes are being collected by the visitors, because this is where those monies are now going. This is an artist rendering of the project, the whale project. The picture we just saw was right here. This is where the whale itself will actually be, the plaza and the beautiful reflecting pool. It's going to be phenomenal. It's going to be iconic, I think, for Juneau and for Alaska. We love it. But we do not believe it should be visitor taxes, entry fee taxes, that are paid to this. There will also be an elevated walkway that's going to be built out over the water to an artificial island that's being constructed here. And then another elevated walkway that goes back to the land and a viewing point for the whale from this point, and then another elevated walkway that comes around so you can visit the whale. The bid for this entire structure was $13 million. The city and borough only had, I believe, $10 million of head taxes allocated to this, so they've gone back to the drawing board. They've let the contract just for this portion, which I believe is $2.3 million, the foundation for the for the whale itself, and then they will contract this out in phases to build the rest of this development. They've just started on this. There's excavator down there now starting to work on the foundation for this. And these are examples of projects that concern us as the industry. Are we collecting too much money from these passengers? There's no real benefit to the ship for this expenditure of funds. Very little benefit to the passengers. There's so many different things that the passengers do in a community like Juneau. They spend money in, you know, for local excursions and many other things in local retail stores. And does it make sense to try and lure them away from the business district down to view this whale sculpture when they could be spending money in Juneau and paying sales taxes to the local community? So this is an example, and again, my apologies to the representative for Juneau. I don't mean to pick on you or this project, but it really is an example that we think is egregious, particularly in these times that we find ourselves in, with the austere measures that all Alaskans are going to have to go through. Should we be spending tax dollars on a man-made island, elevated causeway, and a whale sculpture? And so that really goes to my last point about the issues with 252, with House Bill 252. As I mentioned before, there's potential legal problems. We had an agreement with the state. A deal's a deal. We adhered to our portion of the deal. We'd hope the state would adhere to their portion of the deal. It could potentially, as a member of the committee pointed out on Wednesday, jeopardize all the existing taxes, not only the taxes that the state collects under this, but taxes that the local communities collect as well. And finally, there's no mechanism. These are restricted funds. We appreciate the governor and what he has done in terms of trying to fix the fiscal problem. I think he has tremendous courage for coming through with a plan that really comprehensively addresses the fiscal situation that we're in. And I applaud him for that. But these are not general funds. These are restricted funds. They can't be used to close the budget gap on the many different problems that we have facing the state. They can only be used on specific capital projects that are tied to services for the ship and the passenger. And so we don't see this as being a legitimate method of generating revenue from all the visitors that come to Alaska to try and help in filling that fiscal gap. And there's really been no good analysis on how the existing funds are being expended. I gave the example of the island. There's many others out there that we feel the state has some responsibility, fiduciary responsibility, in collecting these taxes, making certain they're expended within the law. And we haven't seen in 252 any plan for how these restricted funds are going to actually be used. What are the projects that are needed that these restricted funds can be used for? And there's really been no economic analysis of the impact on private sector jobs. Our family saw it firsthand in our business, what happened the last time we went down this road. And our fear is that something similar happens again. And we feel it's incumbent upon the sponsors of the bill, the legislature, if it's going to pass the bill, to lay out what the impact are from the private sector jobs. I mean, you're taking private sector dollars, putting them into public funds, and the jobs go with those dollars. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity.
Will you take at least one more question?
Certainly. Happy to answer any questions.
And actually, Mr. Chair, that was the longest answer to my question, any question I've ever heard. So it was very thorough. Thank you, Mr. Binkley. I do, just so, and I may have missed this, but is it correct that right now there's only $2 million that is going out in this restricted kind of way? So if we're talking about closing any gap, it would just be a $2 million gap. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's correct. Currently, my understanding, and revenue can certainly answer that much more accurately than I can, but my understanding is there's about $2 million out of all that's collected. There's only $2 million that's retained by the state. The rest of it goes all out to the communities for all the projects that you see around the state, like the whale. And only $2 million is retained by the state. I believe the Commissioner of Revenue on Wednesday, or not the Commissioner,
the Director,
mentioned that that fund was maybe overspent last year, and so I don't know that there's any proposal on spending the fund this year, but just he can answer that better than I. I better.
Okay. He will be. We've got a list of questions that he'll be answering at the next meeting. But just so we don't single out Juneau, can you give us a couple examples from other ports?
Well, there are some ports that are collecting the money. They don't have any specific project to spend the money on, and there's an accumulated pool of money looking for projects. So that's another concern. And many ports are very responsible, and many of the expenditures are legitimate expenditures. Again, I don't want to single out Juneau, but, some of the entry fee head taxes are utilized in the general fund for general government expenses, and they have a formula. And they believe, that it's legitimate to utilize these entry fee taxes for general government use. And I think there's about $1.6 million annually that goes into general government, and they identify how they think there's a nexus to certainly the passengers that come off the ships.
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the money that does go into the department's operating fund actually is designated towards specific activities that are specifically related to cruise ship actions. It's the people that are operating or holding the crossing flags for passengers to cross streets. It's other direct support services. It's adding an ambulance in Juneau during the summer, so we have the ability to respond to several thousand, or actually close to 8,000 people at times, in a single day, that have increased the population of downtown Juneau. So those activities are clearly defined and clearly related to the activities of the cruise ships. The projects are vetted and received an analysis that they do comply with the statute that requires that they be affiliated with the cruise ship and passengers. And so Juneau has gone through. They're not just spending money here or there. These are things that they believe enhance the passengers' experience, because there's activities that are already drawing people out towards the Department of Labor. We see people walking along Egan Drive on the sidewalk all the time right now. So there are people there. This creates a safer access to, it's going to be ultimately be a park. So there are legitimate reasons for spending the money that we receive. That money is not the state money. That money is money that is cruise ship tax assessed by Juneau for Juneau, and an increase in this amount of money is not going to be going to any specific community. It's going to be going into a pot that will be used in the area or the region or any of the first seven ports for vessels that can get a benefit from having capital that can support cruise ships and cruise ship passengers.
Representative Hughes, you had one more?
More? Yes, I did, and I don't have the page number, but it's the one after the most recent pie chart where you, Ledge Legal had their opinion in 2009. It already makes me wonder if we're doing something wrong as a state, because you didn't go into detail on it, but it's saying that according to the federal limitations in case law, it actually has to go to a specific vessel that's collecting. It should be supporting that specific, not even just generally vessels. And I'm almost it almost sounds like we're running adrift of that. Would you agree?
Through the chair, Madam Vice Chair, our interpretation of the law is that it has to, as is indicated in this legal memo from Ledge Legal Services, is that it has to follow the specific vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So if the taxes are collected from the passengers getting off of one vessel, you can't take those funds and move them to another port where another vessel calls. They're required to be expended for a service to that vessel, not any vessel. So you can't, even though it may be a service to a vessel, it has, as this is saying, it has to be a service to the vessel from which the taxes are collected. So you can't, for example, collect the tax off a vessel that calls in Juneau and then use that for a service to a vessel that calls in Ketchikan. that this is saying that it has to be specific to the vessel from which the taxes are collected.
And follow-up comment, and that's it. And it just goes back, if you have some ports that have money, a pool of money that they're collecting, and we're having trouble how we're going to provide those services, although there are some legitimate ones, it begs the question, do they need additional at this time? So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Keto. Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I just want to add very briefly that some of the issues that we're getting into are legal issues, and it'd be probably better to have Department of Law up for the questions.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I don't pretend to be a lawyer, and some of these are my, you know, just my plain reading of some of the statutes in the Constitution. So I'm not suggesting that I am a lawyer or have any business giving legal advice or opining on the legalities of some of these things.
And again, for the committee, if you have any questions, get them into Conrad, and we'll have answers hopefully before the next time that we hear the bill. But any further questions for?
I might ask one.
Please join us.
Thank you, Mr. Bigley, for being here. Appreciate that. And you know,
please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Sorry, Representative Dan Ortiz from District 36. Along the same lines of, you know, the legitimate use of these funds, et cetera, there was an independent audit of how these funds have been spent here recently this past summer. Are you aware of that? I think I'm aware that there was an independent audit. Would you concur with that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I am not completely familiar, but I've heard that there was an audit requested by Legislative Budget and Audit over how these funds were expended. I'm not certain that audit has been completed.
Okay.
I know last year there was a proposal, I believe, in Senate Finance to maybe pull some of these funds back. The statute that that authorizes the legislature to send these funds to the communities, local communities, it's permissive language. It says they may be sent to the communities. I think the opinion in Senate Finance last year was that the funds were overspent. Perhaps these funds aren't being spent properly in some of these local communities. Let's not appropriate the money out to the local communities this year. Let's have the state keep those funds so we can better monitor how they're expended and appropriate them out ourselves. And I think that, although it was concluded in conference committee that they would be appropriated out to the communities, I think the audit that was requested through budget and audit kind of came out of that
process. I think I can address it. We have two members of LBNA sitting next to each other up here, and it was requested, and it should be in March, April.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that they weren't going to be able to start until after the first of the year. I think they mentioned maybe having it available by March.
That helps.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Any further questions? You were right in a lot. And I'd like to let the record reflect you were invited up here when you came.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any further questions for John? Thanks again. We've got a few minutes left. Is there anybody in the room? I'll open it up to testimony in the room.
Or
another one. Oh. Oh, let me guess. Fred Reeder. It's Friday. Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Fred Reeder, member of Alaska Act. I want to thank the committee for letting me come and make probably a briefer comment than Mr. Binkley back there.
Mr. Binkley is a trained professional.
And to the committee, my name's Fred Reeder with Alaska Act. I've been a lifelong member of the city of Sitka, born there in 1952 in Mount Edgecombe Hospital. I've got, there's five of us in my family. All five of us work in the visitor industry. Two of them now live in Juneau. I don't hold that against them, just so long as they don't take on crimson and black. But other than that, let's see if I do this right. I don't know which button I hit. Maybe that one. That one right there. Okay. Just to give you a brief history of Alaska Act, you know the history of the 2006 initiative, and those of us in the Alaskans who have businesses in Alaska or work for businesses in Alaska, we put our faith in the cruise lines to fight the initiative, and bad on us because it didn't work. So cruise lines, by their very nature, set up their schedules, their itineraries, 2 years in advance. So while we thought there would be an effect, we didn't know there would be an effect of the tax. Along comes 2007, it's implemented. 2 years later, we see the effects of the itinerary changes. So Alaska Act was formed. Now that we saw the effects, the decrease in passengers, what were we going to do as Alaskans to get those passengers back? And I'll go through some of the hardships that many of our members faced. John alluded to his 60 employees. I can tell you some of the ones that I had to tell didn't have jobs. It's not a pretty thing. That didn't have to happen. So Alaska Act was formed to figure out if there was a way to modify this legislation, which we thought was illegal at the time. And John alluded to much of the legal aspect of it. We thought it was illegal, and come to find out that it probably was in how it was written and how the funds were being expended. So we took it upon ourselves as businessmen. There's over 900 members of Alaska Act, Alaskans, some business owners, some workers for businesses. We formed Alaska Act, and there were lots of newspaper articles written about us, what we planned to do, how we planned to do it. It went throughout Alaska, and many of you were in the legislature at the time that Alaska Act was going through the halls. Hundreds, thousands of emails to legislators. We mobilized significantly our resources to try and fight this because it had so severely impacted our members, severely, and also our local communities. So that we got involved and we said, we had this growth. It's much like if you eat chocolate every night and you like chocolate and they raise the price of chocolate, you start eating vanilla because it's cheaper. Well, that's what happened to the cruise ships and the passengers. They left. They were eating chocolate. We were going high, and all of a sudden, they didn't come anymore. But we still had employees. We still had bank payments to make. So we had to figure out, how can we get passengers back? And we saw a direct connection between the regulatory aspects of the state of Alaska and the impact it had on our business. And the other day I was reading in the newspaper, there was a representative, and excuse me, I forget who it was, and they were talking about raising the gas tax, the gasoline tax for motor vehicles. And the question at the end was, we don't know what the impact of this tax will be. We should really find out, what is this tax on gasoline, what hardship? I mean, in Alaska we have huge transportation problems. We have extreme costs in transportation. What's it going to do? At the very least, when you implement a tax, you should ask the question, what are the impacts before we implement it? That's a prudent thing. And I think me as a lifelong Alaskan, I recognize that there's a hole in the bucket. And we got to do something to fill the bucket. But as an Alaskan, I would expect the legislature to do their due diligence in saying, here's where we need to go. This will be the impacts, and explain to Alaskan what the impacts will be, not just to say, we need to put money in the bucket. So that's kind of an aside on my part on the taxes. But with the head tax on the cruise ship passenger, we know exactly what will happen if we raise this tax. We know exactly we'll probably lose 156,000 passengers coming into Juneau. I use Juneau because they all come to Juneau, so it's easy to track. One of the things I've done for the company I work for since 2006, no, 1996. My goodness, I've been doing this a long time. Is I do the numbers and I give them to, I work the numbers of all the passengers, and if you see it from McDowell, it probably came from me first. So that's something I just, I kind of get into tracking passenger numbers. So, so anyway, that's why we got involved, was our businesses were hurting, our communities were hurting. If you take a look at just Juneau, for example, in 2008, they had 1,032,000 passengers. They have not come back to that level yet. But in 2011, they had 875,000 passengers. 156,000 passengers less came to Juneau in 2011. And you think, well, 156,000 passengers, what does that mean? McDowell will retell you that each passenger who comes on a cruise ship is $188 to the city of Juneau. That's what they spend here. They spend more in Juneau than any other port, predominantly because they have higher-end tours, helicopters, whale-watching boats, whatnot. So you extrapolate the $188 times 156,000, Juneau lost $29 million in revenue coming into the city. Approximately 7% in sales tax. Their sales tax is less, but because it's greater, $188, it averages out to about $2 million they lost in general sales tax revenue that they could use on schools, on anything. The key as an Alaskan, and I should have told you beforehand, I'm a former mayor of the city of Sitka. And don't hold that against me. I would much rather have, as a mayor, sales tax revenue than any other form of revenue, because I can use it for anything in my community. You give me a dedicated fund like a head tax, I'm restricted on what I can do with it. I can't use it for my schools.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Reeder, I have a number of questions for you. I'll just sort of rattle them off.
Okay.
You talked about sales tax. The word that I hear from most southeastern Alaskans is they're worried about the impact of a second sales tax because so many communities have them. And this seems to be so prevalent, this position, this sort of southeastern position. You don't share that concern.
I suppose because I have traveled I go to many places, Arizona for one. I go frequently. I own a home in Arizona that we get to hopefully when I retire. But they have a community sales tax and they have a state sales tax. And the state sales tax is the same. I think it's like 3%. And then each community tax on whatever theirs is. So I'm used to paying sales taxes, and I think most people who come to Alaska are used to sales taxes. Now,
yes.
So from my perspective, that's not going to stop me an extra 2-3% or whatever a sales tax would be.
But your concern is with it stopping prospective passengers. And so I'm just trying to equate these two. You're worried about, this is a $15 fee impact. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Okay. And I know that in toto, that adds up to a great deal of money, and that for groups it looks larger. But wouldn't the sales tax impact those passengers even more, or is the hope that they wouldn't hear about it till they arrive, or what?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. A question to you. When you travel, do you look at the sales tax?
No.
Right. As one person and myself, I don't look. So most tourist destinations recoup the cost of the impact of visitors through a sales tax. You can look at the Klink Field in Seattle and many others throughout the nation. They use a sales tax as a vehicle for local impacts by visitors.
Thank you. You made a big point about talking about economic implications. You talked about the gas tax. The legislature needs revenue.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, well, currently we could only operate on our sustainable budget this year is $1.8 billion.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
That's our sustainable budget. If that was our budget, we would absolutely devastate the economy. And so should we be looking at, and I only ask this because you brought this up, should we be looking at the impact of operating budget cuts as well? Should we be, you talked about due diligence, that should be part of the economic analysis as well.
I think it has to be, because to get off subject for 1 minute, if I'm 130 seconds to answer your question, Representative, I think Alaskans would require that you lessen the amount you spend to the point that you can justify that the expenditures that you are making are at a level of service that they require. And I hate getting off and talking Alaska politics, but I've been here for 63 years, so I guess I guess that gives me license.
I guess my last point, and I don't doubt that, particularly the $36 figure, I think is sort of more meaningful, and so I can understand its impact than a $15 figure. I mean, just logically, it seems that way. But the impact of the recession was so profound. We had 10% national unemployment. We now have 5%. It just strikes me that we were running a $1.4 trillion deficit. Now it's about $600 or $700 billion, which is awful. But it just strikes me that was clearly a major factor in the downturn.
You have to remember, Representative, through the chair, the ships were redeployed before the recession, after our tax, but before the recession. So they didn't know there was going to be this huge big crash in 08 and 09 when they redeployed their ships. But we felt the effect of it. The ships still came full. Because I track the numbers. The ships are still full. In fact, they're always 1% to 2% to 3% higher than what's originally forecast. So,
all right. Thank you.
You want me to continue? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reeder, so one of the things I think you mentioned is the sales tax, and one of the things I have a concern about. So individuals that are making adequate money that can afford to have houses in other communities might not be thinking as much about a sales tax, but a single parent with two kids living on a fixed income might have significant problems with trying to go out and buy. And in some cases here in Juneau, we don't have an exemption for food or other items. We're paying that. They are paying a higher percentage of their income just to survive, and it's a significant burden on them. So a sales tax in a community might not have as dramatic of an impact on a tourist or other individuals that are making enough money, but it does have a dramatic impact on individuals that are already struggling to survive. When you do the calculation, I think if a $15 per head, even on a $300 cruise, if we can get a $300 cruise, that's 5%. That's like a 5% sales tax. If somebody gets off of the boat and they buy one item for $300, or they buy five items for three items for $100, they've paid that 5% already in a sales tax. So I guess I'm feeling like we're, as far as the passenger is concerned, arguing at about a very little bit of money, and I think we do have statute in place that addresses the issue about where the money can be spent, which was the big concern of the lawsuit. So it seems like we're just talking about a value, and then our job as the state is to make sure that money is spent appropriately. So I guess it's more of a comment than, but I'm just concerned about a sales tax and that impact of that sales tax on lower income individuals in our community.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I can appreciate the hardship that Alaskans who would struggle with a state sales tax. Many localities don't put it on food. They don't put it on housing. They put it on luxury items, you know, things like that. So those are all things that can be worked out in so that your average maybe tourist or visitor, as we like to call them, who come to Alaska, you could target those items that they may be involved with. Hotels, you know, I hate to throw out hotels, they'll knife just came in my back. But I think there are ways to direct them. So maybe if I can get going, so it's Friday. The tax was reduced from $46 to $34.50, and Mr. Binkley went through that. That was the additional, that was the offset on the head taxes that communities had already charged. The funds are to be used for facilities and service for passengers and ships. And you have to be very clear on that. And that's why an increase in this tax doesn't help the state's fiscal problem. It puts money into a fund that can only be used for ships and passengers. And the state, in the legislation, part of what we talked about was to make sure that the state didn't get out of compliance with federal law. And that's why we added in the state's going to review it every 3 years to make sure that the communities aren't spending the money on something that doesn't fit the ship and the passenger. It was our understanding at the time, as these ports develop, as they spend money, well over $100 million now, that at some point they're not going to need as much money, and that tax would be reviewed and maybe lessened. Think about somebody, you know, we've talked about internally within some of the people that I've talked to. I don't think, quite frankly, I probably doubt whether the cruise lines would sue you over this issue. What I think we as Alaskans should be afraid of is passenger X, who was on ship Y, who didn't use, and I'm sorry, Representative Keto, who may find that the causeway, the $10 million that the head tax money that are 12 or 13, whatever, got spent, didn't help the ship, and you had a class action suit on it. I'm worried that we throw out the whole law, or are forced to. Part of the reason why Alaska Act was the group to initiate and work with the state on this issue was that we didn't want, within a group, we didn't want a single community having to raise prices to cover costs in their communities, that would be held against them. And maybe ships say, oh, well, we're not going to go to Sitka, or we're not going to go to Wrangell because, you know, they wanted to do a head tax. So part of the reason was we recognize that there are legal port expenses that need to be covered in ports that have cruise ships. And this was a vehicle, so long as we kept it legal and it was reviewed and the expenses of the communities were lawful, that it was a way that we could get projects paid for within our communities. So the review is very important. On behalf of the state, you should ensure that it's being done, that the Department of Law has vetted these projects, that they say, yeah, that, you know, Sitka, you can use the money on that because we can see that's a value to the ship and the passenger. So I think it's incumbent on you to make sure that that's done, because that's in the law. And then all ports, they get the $5, you know, and they use it, and they're supposed to use it. They have to use it for the passenger in the vessel. The impact, the cruise line said that they would bring back more ships. They did that. They honored their agreement. We went from 875,000. We'll go over 1 million this year in the Port of Juneau. And I use Juneau just because they all come here, so it's easy for me to. I know what Juneau's going to get, over 1 million passengers this year. They honored their agreement. We feel, Alaska Act feels, that the state needs to honor their agreement to what they agreed to in 2010, working with our organization and through the legislature. And the issues. The industry, we feel, has lived up to their part of it. They've brought the ships back. We've got a robust visitor industry now in the cruise sector. We don't want to see a dedicated tax on our industry that really doesn't help Alaska. It doesn't help the guy out in Anaktuvuk Pass You can't use the funds out there. You can only use it in the ports that are served by the cruise ships.
Representative Josephson.
I know you're about to wrap up, Mr. Reeder. I guess I'm still a little bit confused in that given that we've shrunk our capital budgets to only what is required to get a federal match from multiples of billions of dollars, there's got to be great infrastructure needs in Southeast Alaska. I'll ask you to respond to that.
I would answer that by saying there probably were great infrastructure needs as it pertains to those things that go for cruise ships and their passengers. I can look at my own community, Sitka. We saved money from Sitka. Having been mayor there, I can tell you we're socially liberal and fiscally conservative. You know, and I can get by with the socially liberal part, and I'd like the fiscally conservative part of my community. We save money and then we pay cash for projects. That's how we do things. So we have saved head tax money over the last number of years, and we're redoing our dock, tender dock area, as well as our visitor center where the passengers first come into. We were woefully inadequate in restrooms, especially for ladies. We had building that holds 700, we had 4 holes. That's not enough. The lines were long. So, but after that project in my own community, mm-hmm. there's not much we need, at least not in the near term. So mm-hmm. other communities are the same. When you can go to a community that they need to put a whale statue, is that really necessary? I know I'm not going to endear myself to a lot of people, but back to I'm an Alaskan, 63 years old, I pretty much say what I think. So I think we're getting to the point where the number of projects are going to be less that qualify for the use of the funds. And that's why I think the department needs to do due diligence on where communities are spending these funds mm-hmm. before they're spent. Because I can envision a day if there were a suit and someone were to sue over money that got spent in a community, and the community, they don't have the money, where are they going to go? They're going to come back to the state. So that's why I say you got to protect yourselves. I don't know if that answers the question. But
yes, it's a follow-up. And it's really your last page of your PowerPoint is where you mentioned a potential suit.
Oh.
It seems like that would still be true. Given that this was a settlement, it was largely based on a reduction of the tax from 48 to 36, and a sort of a wink and a nod kind of thing, although there was linkage to the tonnage requirement. But I guess relative to the lawsuit feature, if a single passenger could get standing, it's that vulnerability is always there anyway, isn't it?
A lawsuit. Representative Joseph, through the chair, you're right on that. But the point was at the time, $34.50 was not just it started out at $50, and then they reduced it four to pay for the Ocean Rangers, and then we reduced it down because it was a duplication of fees that were already being paid. So we were reducing it down, but the review portion of the law was the important part because we wanted to make sure that if $34.50 was too much, then it would be under the review process, it would be come back and say, you know, for projects we've got that communities are asking for, we don't need that much money. Or we've got projects on the book that are legal that communities are asking for, $34.50 is not enough. But you have to prove that there's that nexus between the vessel and the passengers and the community. So the $34.50, I don't think is a stagnant number. I think it's and that's why the review process, because we wanted to make sure that we could prove that we were the projects we were funding were legal projects. So there's been no basis to raise the $15. There's no projects on the book that require it. There's no future projects that communities have asked for that we say, gee, we need another $100 million because these ports are clamoring for these projects. So without a basis for asking for the $15, just to put it in a fund that you can only spend on ports, doesn't seem like that, you know, we're not at that point yet where you've made a case to raise the $15.
Thank you.
I mean, that's, so, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sort of. Okay. So with that, I guess I would conclude just by saying Alaska Act, our position is that the $15 is not warranted at this time. There's been no basis to request the $15. It can't be used to help this the state fiscal problem. It's not like the visitor industry is not willing to look at what ways we can help, because we all live here. We want to make the state a better place. We recognize that there is a problem because of the price of oil. We just can't go out and start pumping more oil and to bring it up even at $30 a barrel or whatever it is. So we want to help. We recognize there's a problem, but HB 252 is not going to help and probably will hinder. We've got the data to show exactly what the effects will be. Thousands of jobs lost, millions of dollars in lost tax revenue. That doesn't get us where we need to go. That gets us worse.
You got time for two questions.
Yeah.
Representative Hedo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I would dispute the concern that there are not needs. We do have larger vessels, and while the Juneau port expansion project is underway, that does not mean that some of those vessels might desire to pull into another port in Southeast that can't accommodate those larger vessels. We also have communities that are relatively young in tourism. I mean, despite the fact that we've had tourism in Southeast Alaska, there are communities that have limited numbers of vessels, and if they start attracting additional vessels, there are additional needs for port facilities. All of those things are out there, and I can't say for other communities, but I can say we're spending a lot of money on a facility in order to accommodate two larger vessels because the larger vessels were saying they wanted to come into Juneau, and that's going to be an issue for other communities, and I don't suspect in the too distant future.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I would agree with that, but I think we get the cart before the horse or afterwards in our budgeting of it. The community should be coming and saying, we've got these projects, and do you have this money? And if you say, no, but is what we'll do over years, over the next 3 years, we will set aside for that project so that communities do have a source. That was why it was controlled by the state, so that communities could come to the state to fund their project, because they may not collect enough in 1 year to cover a project. But they could get on the book and say, okay, we've highlighted this that these ports need. So at this point, we don't see the projects on the book that are definitive and costed out that would warrant the $15.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we're up against the hour. And with all due respect to my colleague from Juneau, as well as my relatives that live here, and I think, I'll just say as an aside, I think the whale sculpture idea sounds really cool. The drawing, it's got me curious of what it might look like someday. But I'm wondering, do you think, based on the federal law, that really falls into the definition of a service? We were talking about restrooms. I understand that's a service, but a whale sculpture and this, I kind of wondering whether we're even running afoul of the federal requirement. We're talking about the state taking some responsibility, making sure this money is spending correctly, but I'm wondering if we might have a problem with a federal government questioning how these projects are being used. And maybe that's part of the vetting process, and maybe they okayed the whale project, but I just don't see how that's a service like a restroom. Do you have a comment on that?
Vice Chair Hughes, through the chair. I'm not sure that one passes the stink test. And can I leave it at that?
And with that, we'll thank you again for testifying today. And a little cleanup for tomorrow. We're going to be holding this bill over, obviously, and tomorrow will be public testimony on both the bills that we had today. For those of you that are listening that want to participate, please go to your local... local information office, legislative information office, a limited number of off-net lines are available, and if you need to get one, call my office at 465-4954, and we'll thanks again for everybody that's in the room, and with that, we will adjourn.